So in our life,
things are all the time happening with sentient beings. We form relationships, and then they change, and then this happens, and then that happens. And if we're not careful, we can be buffeted around by the emotions that we feel at any particular time. So it's important to look beyond these superficial reactions, or I should say maybe these reactions to the superficial, and instead look deeply into what our relationship with sentient beings is about. If we do that, then we find that it's about loving kindness, compassion, the wish for ourselves and others to be free of all the various kinds of dukkha in cyclic existence. So if we come back to that basic essential point, how we're all the same, how we're all experiencing the three kinds of dukkha, how we all want to be happy and free, and how we all have the Buddha potential. We hold that as our deepest way of relating to sentient beings. Then we can have a heartfelt and very constructive relationship with each being, especially by generating bodhicitta, wanting to attain enlightenment for their benefit. And so let's generate that thought right now, that noble aspiration. So we were on verse 107, right? We started that last time. So how can there be a wheel of karma? So this question comes that if everything's empty of inherent existence, how can karma function? Although devoid of intrinsic reality, here's an analogy. Although devoid of intrinsic reality, a reflection of the moon can appear in a cup of water. Karma and its effects, too, manifest in diverse false guises. So within this mere appearance, I'll follow the norms of ethics. Okay, so because karma is empty, because it has no independent existence, therefore, it can bring effects. Because if things were truly existent, okay, they would be independent of all other factors. Okay, true existence means it stands on its own. It doesn't depend on any other factors, which makes it independent. If it's independent, then it can't be produced by causes and conditions. And it can't produce results because being produced by causes and conditions makes it dependent on those causes and conditions. Producing results means it changes due to causes and conditions. Okay, so if something is truly existent, it's independent. If it's independent, then it can't depend on causes and conditions. Okay. If it doesn't depend on causes and conditions, then it's a permanent phenomena. It can't function. Okay. So then causes could not bring results. So if things were truly existent, there's no way that a seed could grow into a tree. There's no way that an infant could grow into an adult. There's no way that you could mix together various ingredients and get a cake. You know, none of that stuff would be able to function because every single thing would have its own independent essence, unrelated to everything else, which would mean that it couldn't change. Okay? So it's because things are empty that they can function, that everything is possible. Now, there's a quote from Nagarjuna like that. He says, because things are empty, then everything's possible. Something like that. Okay. I'm not very good at quoting. Okay. So the idea here is in the analogy, they talk about the moon that's appearing in the lake. We'll change it from a cup of water to a lake. Okay. So there's no moon in the lake, but the moon appears. How does it appear? Due to causes and conditions. Okay. So the reflection of the moon, while empty of moon, arises. The reflection arises, but it doesn't depend on just one thing. It depends on the water, it depends on it being dark, it depends on the moon, it depends on the moon being in a certain stage. You know, on a new moon, you wouldn't get a reflection of the moon. Okay? So there's lots of different conditions that are going on that produce this reflection of the moon in the water. It's not just one thing. And also, it's not just causelessly. It's not just that, you know, you see a moon in the water and there's no cause. You know, there's causes, so there's functioning, there's things happening. So even though there's no moon there, there's a reflection of the moon. So similarly, although our actions are not truly existent, the experiences that we have as the result of our actions are not truly existent, we as a human being are not truly existent. Our feelings are not truly existent. Even though none of these things are truly existent, they can still appear and they can still function. Okay? How do they function? Because they're dependent. And if you look, we're dependent on causes and conditions, aren't we? Yeah, we're dependent on our parents, we're dependent on the mind stream that continues from previous lives, dependent on all the food that we've eaten, we're dependent on the conditioning that we've received. So we're a dependent phenomena. We're not a truly existent one. There's no solid core that's me here, but rather what we call I appears depending upon all these many conditions coming together in a certain way. Similarly, the actions we do depend on many factors. Now, if you think, what is an action? Like, let's say, lying to somebody. Yeah? We've all done that, right? So we talk about the negative action of lying. But what is the negative action of lying? Is it the words? Is it the sound waves? Is it our intention? Is it the other person hearing it? Is it the other person understanding it? Is it the situation itself? You know, when we start analyzing, we can't identify one single thing that is the act of lying. But when we don't analyze, we say, I lied. Or similarly, when we tell the truth, what's the action of telling the truth? Again, is it the motivation? Is it the sound waves? Is it, you know, the other person hearing? Is it their understanding? Is it the situation that we're describing? Now, it depends on all of those things, but it's not one single one of them. So the action of telling the truth also is dependent. Thus, it is not truly existent. Okay, it doesn't exist by its own nature. From its own side. Okay? So things can function even though they're empty. So that's why Dhamma Rakshita says, so within this mere appearance, I'll follow the norms of ethics. So even though things do not truly exist, it's still valuable to follow the norms of ethics, to restrain ourselves from negative actions of body, speech, and mind, to take care to create positive actions of body, speech, and mind, because even though these actions and their results are empty, they still function on a conventional level. They still appear. Okay? So our actions can produce happiness and suffering. Now, sometimes we think of happiness and suffering as truly existent. But, you know, we have to see that happiness and suffering are also mere appearances. Okay? Because you wake up in the morning and you say, I'm happy. Well, what is that happiness? Okay, so there's the feeling aggregate of happiness, you know, the feeling aggregate, right? And that feeling aggregate at that particular time, there's the feeling of happiness. But what is that feeling of happiness? Does it exist on its own? Doesn't it depend on there being clear and knowing in the mind? Doesn't it depend on there being a primary state of mind? Doesn't it depend on a cause that produces it? Doesn't it depend on there being a person who experiences it? Okay? So when we look, it just even when we say I'm happy, that happiness is just something that appears. It's quite interesting in our meditation when we're feeling happy, instead of reacting to the feeling of happiness, to sit there and ask ourselves, how do I know that I'm happy? And this is very interesting because when we ask ourselves, how do I know I'm happy, we're beginning to analyze, well, what is this happiness? Okay. So we say, when we say, how do we know I'm happy, then we think of different ways in which we, different qualities of happiness. And then we see that we say I'm happy simply because in dependence upon these certain qualities, we label it happiness. Yeah. So it's quite interesting to sit and watch, you know, how do I know I'm happy? Or to ask ourselves, what is this happiness that I say I'm feeling? What is it? Can you find the feeling of happiness? Okay. And so similarly, when we're in a bad mood, instead of just saying, oh, I'm in a bad mood, you know, because that's seeing our bad mood is inherently existent, just ask ourselves, well, what is this bad mood that I say I'm feeling? What really is it? Can I find this bad mood? Okay, and then you start looking for this bad mood and try and find it. Or alternatively, you ask yourselves, how do I know I'm in a bad mood? You might say, well, you know, my stomach feels in a certain way. And when my stomach feels that way, it means I'm in a bad mood. But is that sensation in your stomach the bad mood? It's not. So, okay, how do I know I'm in a bad mood? Well, my stomach feels that way, but that feeling isn't the bad mood. So what is this bad mood I say I'm feeling? Okay? And you start to ask, you know, bad mood, is it primary consciousness? Is it, what is this bad mood? You know, can I draw a line around it? Can I isolate it? Can I pull it out of everything and say, this is it, now I've got it? You know? It's really fascinating because when we do this kind of analysis, it shows how when we don't do this kind of analysis, what goes on? You know, how when we don't do this analysis, the mood just appears so real and we take the ball and run with it and react to it. But as soon as we start to ask, well, what is this bad mood? Or how do I know I'm feeling a bad mood? Where is this bad mood? You know, on what basis do I say I'm in a bad mood? Then it all gets kind of a bit blurry, doesn't it? And this thing that we thought was this real bad mood, all of a sudden just, you know, we kind of just can't grab onto it anymore. We can't find it. It's just really fascinating when you start to do this, okay? And we start to question all these things that we feel so strongly exist. Yeah? So it can be quite revolutionary. Yeah? Like when we hold the idea, you know, I'm unlovable. Well, what is that unlovable quality about me? Find it. On what basis do I say I'm unlovable? How do I know I'm unlovable? You know, and you start investigating it. Yeah, what actually is this thing of being unlovable? Huh? I mean, I believe it exists. I believe that I am it. But what is it? Okay? Or when our mind flips and we think, oh, I am so talented, better than everybody else. You know? Then to ask ourselves, well, what is this talent that, you know, I'm so proud of? How do I know I'm so talented? Well, I can change tires and children can't. So I'm better than her. You know? So then you look at, okay, well, what's that talent of changing tires? Where does that exist? Does it exist in my arms? Does it exist in my mind? What is this talent of changing tires? Okay? So we just start investigating all these things that we think are so real and asking ourselves, well, what are they? Okay? And it kind of breaks it down. And what we discover is when we do ultimate investigation, asking ourselves, what does this word really refer to? So what does this talent really, this word, my talent, really refer to? What does being unlovable really refer to? What does, you know, whatever it is, attribute we're talking, you know, lonely, oh, that's a good one. I'm lonely. Okay, I'm in a bad mood, I'm in a good mood. What do these words really refer to? And we begin to see them when we don't analyze, there's an appearance of some kind of something. Okay? But when we do analyze, it completely evaporates. Okay? And so the nice thing is when you're in a bad mood, when you do the ultimate analysis and you can't find this bad mood that you thought was so real, then the bad mood just completely disappears. It doesn't even exist conventionally at that point. Yeah? Because you've been able to, you've looked and you look for that bad mood and you can't find it. And then, you know, usually after that, just even conventionally, you no longer feel in a bad mood. Okay, so the point is that even though things are empty, they still exist. They exist on the level of appearance. They exist nominally by being merely labeled. They exist conventionally. They do not exist inherently. Okay, so because they do exist conventionally and things arise due to causes and condition, then it behooves us to observe karma and its effects. Because our actions create effects. Okay? Okay, then verse 108. When in a dream the fire at the end of the universe blazes, I feel terrified by the heat, though it has no intrinsic reality. Likewise, although the hell realms and its likes are devoid of intrinsic reality, out of trepidation for being smelt, burnt, and so on, all forsake negative actions. Okay. So when you're dreaming, if you're having a dream that it's the end of the universe and the fire is raging and it's consuming everything up, okay, you might be afraid. You know, you're terrified by the heat, even though there's no real heat there. There's the appearance of heat. There's appearance of fire. There's an appearance of a dream me who's getting burnt. Okay? But there's no fire, no real fire. There's no real me. None of this. Okay? But still in the dream, those things appear and we experience them. Okay? Similarly, in our lives, you know, there can be fire or whatever, you know, the fire of the hell realms. And if we've created the cause to be born there, then we experience it. Okay? So even though it too is not truly existent, even though it too is not findable upon analysis, it still functions. Okay? It can still be created by causes and conditions. It seems to me that when you, if you're in a situation of fire, if you meditate on emptiness, then the appearance of the fire is going to disappear. Because you're going to analyze, you know, because when you're feeling terrified of the fire, you're grasping at an inherently existent fire and an inherently existent person. When you analyze those things and you find no actual fire and no actual person, you know, when it's only the emptiness of those things that appear to your mind, then, you know, the conventional appearance of an eye that's being burned is no longer there. Okay, so that's what happens at when there's direct perception of emptiness. Only emptiness appears. Not the conventional phenomena. Okay? So that's why, you know, if you're having very frightful appearances, if you meditate on emptiness, you know, then you start looking at the deeper nature of things and the conventional object no longer appears to you. And so emptiness can really dissolve all fears at that time. Because you see, there's nothing there to be afraid of. Yeah, there's no real fire there. Now, what I think is so interesting, and they talk about the hell realms and the human realms and things like that. Whenever, you know, we ask lamas, well, are the hell realms real? Okay. Then, you know, sometimes you get a variety of different answers, you know. Yes, they're real. They're real in the sense that conventionally they exist. Sometimes you'll hear, oh, but they're like illusions. That's speaking from the viewpoint of, you know, when you analyze emptiness, then things, the hell realms and everything appear like illusions. But the thing is, that seems to me, because we always ask these kind of questions from the basis of being a human being, as if what we perceive now is reality. And those hell realms are dreamt up, and the God realms are dreamt up, you know. So they're just kind of psychological states, or they exist like illusions. But it seems to me that all the six realms equally are illusory. Okay? So it's not like our human realm is real and the hell realms are somehow less real, or the God realms are somehow less real. Seems to me when you're born in a specific realm, when you have that karmic appearance, and when there's ignorance in your mind, then you grasp at what's appearing to you as being real, and it appears real. Okay. So even though we might think of the hell realms now, and they seem kind of made up and far away, when you're born in them, they're your environment, and they're real. Yeah. It's like somebody going to prison. Like we might look at now, we talk about the inmates and so on, and we have this feeling, oh, but I'll never wind up in prison. You know, prison, that's kind of this illusory world, you know, in these concrete cubicles, but that has nothing to do with me, even though I feel a lot of compassion for these people. But wait a minute, you know, we don't know what's going to happen in our life. None of the people who are in prison ever anticipated going there. You know? So we don't know what kind of crazy thing could happen in our life. And then all of a sudden there you are in that environment, and then it seems extremely real, doesn't it? Okay. Or we read about what's going on in Lebanon and Israel right now, and you know, all the bombs and the war and everything, and we, you know, it seems so far away from us. But just like that, we could be born in there, and then that becomes our reality. Okay, so I think all the realms are equally existing and also equally illusory. Okay, and all the realms are produced by karma, equally produced by karma. Yeah. So whatever realm we're born into, we're creating karma with our body, speech, and mind. And so we're creating karma for future rebirths, and while we're living in a particular realm, we're experiencing the karma we created in previous rebirths. Okay, so even though we feel heat from this blazing fire in our dream, okay, there's only an appearance of it, okay? There's no, you know, is that you that in when you're dreaming? Is that you who is being burnt in the fire? It's not you, is it? So then you have to ask, is it you that's feeling afraid? That's interesting. We would say yes to that one, wouldn't we? You know? I felt afraid in the dream. I wonder why we say, I felt afraid, but we wouldn't say, I was burnt in a fire. Yeah? So you see, just somehow, just by the appearance of something to the mind, we grasp so strongly onto that appearance that we emotionally react to it. Even though it's a totally false appearance, isn't it?
It's like watching a movie on the screen.
Yeah.
Strong emotions that come up on something that doesn't exist the way it's
Yeah.
Created.
Yeah. Okay. But when you analyze, is there a real you that's terrified in the dream? Mm-hmm. There's not a real you. Okay. So there's no fire in the nightmare, but there is a nightmare. But it's not a real nightmare. Okay. So there's no me in the dream getting burnt, but I'm afraid. But there's no real me who's afraid.
So what is your disproven saying that? What
is
that?
It's what I'm doing is that I'm trying to get us to see, mm-hmm. you know, how we conceive of things, how we hold on to things. Okay.
So can you compare the dream of the fire to us sitting here? Can you do that?
Yeah, in the sense that when you in the middle of the dream appears very real. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So likewise, we're sitting here right now, and our experience together appears very real. Yeah. Now, there's no fire in the dream. Okay. There's no inherently existent people in our experience right now. Okay. So it's an analogy in the sense that there's an appearance of fire in the nightmare, but there's no fire. So there's an appearance of truly existent people right now, but there's no truly existent people. Does that mean that there's no people at all? No, there are people. There are conventionally existent people. There's the appearance of people. Just as there's no fire in the dream, but there was a dream. But there's no truly existent dream. Okay. So, but, you know, this verse 2108, the emphasis is similar to on 107, you know, which is that, you know, even though things don't inherently exist, cause and effect still function. So because cause and effect functions, we need to observe the functioning of karma and its results. Okay, and not get this flippant attitude of, well, it's all empty, so I can do everything I want to because, you know, it's all empty. Yeah, because that view causes a lot of suffering. Okay, so even though the hell realms don't truly exist, still, on a conventional level, sentient beings can be born there. Okay, how are they born there? Due to causes being negative actions.